Inside Crime is brought to you by doTERRA. The doTERRA drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to dispose of unused or expired medication. Learn more at doTERRAsystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with doTERRA. I'm Angeline Hartman. I've spent my career as a journalist covering some of the worst crimes in history. My craft is storytelling. My passion is crime fighting. With this podcast, I'm bringing you more stories, candid conversations with crime victims, their families, and law enforcement. We'll journey together as we learn what happens inside crime. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Season 3 of Inside Crime. My guest today is an American hero, DEA Special Agent Joe Persante. 8 years ago this month, Joe and his team were on a counter-narcotics mission in Afghanistan when they were attacked and barely made it out alive. Joe was part of a special DEA program called FAST. FAST stands for Foreign Advisory and Support Team. The FAST team was DEA's elite overseas tactical team for many years, battling drug cartels across the globe. In Afghanistan, the FAST team zeroed in on drug traffickers linked to the Taliban. Today on Inside Crime, Joe takes us back to that day 8 years ago when his FAST team came under enemy fire. He was shot in the head. It's an inspiring story of survival and perseverance. Welcome to Inside Crime, Joe Persante. Hi, Joe.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you so much for coming on Inside Crime. What an incredible story you have. What drew you to the FAST team?
Anything I've done in life or any activity or any sport I've been involved in, I always wanted to excel to the very top. What is the toughest unit? What is the best, highest level of something? And doing my research in the field, we didn't really know too much of what the FAST team did. Mm-hmm. We didn't get much information. I had a buddy from Phoenix that went on, and I inquired, you know, what are you guys doing? You know,
yeah.
Are you guys just training? Or are you guys doing missions? Or, you know, what's going on there? And he's like, Joe, we're working, you know, with the best, you know, teams in the world. You know, we're kicking butt. You know, we're doing these huge cases, you know, kind of what you would think about on TV, like kind of what DEA does. And it piqued my interest. The selection is very, very grueling, and the pass rate is not very high.
Can you talk a little bit about the selection process to kind of give people an idea of how tough it is to be a part of this? You don't just go like, I want to be a part of the FAST team.
No, it's kind of, they've used different bits and pieces from different special forces selections during this. Mm-hmm. And it's not only physical, it's mental. Not only can you physically do this stuff, but also there's peer evals involved with it. Can you get along with others?
Sure.
You know, are you a well-rounded person? You know, just because you fly through all the activities, you know, you may not be able to live in confined space with people for, you know, periods of time, and that's what you don't want. You know, mm-hmm. you want a team that's cohesive. You don't want a jerk on there. Just to give you an example, I think we started off with 30-something people in my class, and 11 made it to the end.
I think people kind of take it for granted when they hear about these elite teams, right? These elite tactical teams. They don't think about everything that goes into it behind the scenes.
Yeah, when I flew back in the airport to Phoenix and my girlfriend picked me up, she was like, what the hell just happened to you? I was so beat up. I had a blister pretty much everywhere on my feet. I lost all my toenails. And in fact, I had to go to the emergency room the next day.
Oh my
back
goodness.
In Phoenix.
And you're like, I made it.
But I tell you what, it was probably the hardest thing I've done in my life. But you get that feeling of accomplishment when you make it through something like that. You know, self-satisfaction. Wow. I made it through something a lot of people can't do. So it was exciting. Then we started our pre-deployment training, getting ready to a deployment in Afghanistan. And how it usually worked is We had five teams, and each team would rotate approximately 120 days in country to Afghanistan, and we'd be over there for that time. And we were scheduled to go the spring summer tour of 2010 for my first tour. So we did training, getting spooled up, and we went out to Nyland, California, and did land warfare training with SEAL Team 5. Mm-hmm. We did 21 days of that, day and night, and did all the other kind of trainings we need to get situated, and we went to Afghanistan for the first tour. And kind of every time that we went to Afghanistan was a little bit different. What units we worked with, who was available. And during that time, we were stationed at Kandahar Airfield in Kandahar, Afghanistan, our base there. My partner and I, we were with the First Special Forces Group, Green Berets, and we were living in a little base just outside of Kandahar with them. And we were operating in Panjway, which is a very, very hot area. A lot of narcotics and a lot of Taliban presence. And we were doing about a mission a week or so, and it was nuts. We would get intel, military intel, and we had an intel source, DEA intel source over there too. Okay, what areas that we're operating, where are their heroin labs? Or where is their big stockpiles of chemicals and equipment to manufacture? And then we'd work that information up and find out, okay, at this point here, this is the lab. We would try to get information using confidential sources and also using technology to say, okay, looks like they're cooking, and try to get some information when they're doing this. Because we usually want to try to go there when the lab is operating and there's people at the lab. So you plan for as many contingencies as you can. We would try usually to go at night to use darkness, to use our technology with our night vision and lasers, because the enemy over there usually didn't have that. So we try to use that. And we'd go, and we try to seize the lab. We would interview and question anybody that was found there. And if they were deemed to be part of that, and then they would be taken off and basically arrested by our Afghan partner force, and then put through the criminal system in Afghanistan. And we were there too to kind of mentor them, to try to show them how, you know, this is how we do an investigation, this is how we do interviews, you know, this is how we operate.
So you were on your second tour on October 31st, 2011, correct?
Yes.
Can you take me back to that day? What happened?
Yes. We got information that this bazaar was selling chemicals and equipment to manufacture heroin, along with ID making material and small arms. And the bazaar is kind of like an outdoor flea market over there, and they sell miscellaneous stuff to include the items that I previously mentioned. We wanted to go there at night, but the air unit, we couldn't get an air unit to fly us at night during the time the Australians, us, and our Afghan counterparts could go. So we had to use another air unit that could not fly at night. So we weren't too keen on that, because we knew we were probably going to meet resistance and we were going to have a fight on our hands. But it was decided that we're going to go there during the day. We were going to go there early morning hours, just after first light on October 31st, 2011. The plan was we're all going to infill in different locations around the bazaar. The Australians were going to set a outer perimeter around the bazaar to try to keep the insurgents from maneuvering in on us. But this area, they had some little mountains, so they kind of had the high ground on us. Our Afghan partner force was going to clear this little compound right before the bazaar. We were going to link up with them. I was in charge of one group of FAST team members in Afghan partner force to search one end of the bazaar, and then we had another FAST agent, Justin Vanderbilt, who was in charge of another group made up of the similar components to search the other end. So we landed just after first light, and everybody got in place. The Afghans cleared a little compound. We linked up with them. We started receiving sporadic, inaccurate fire pretty much right off the bat. So we began sweeping through the bazaar, still with sporadic gunfire, and we were encountering some evidence items. We were recovering some poppy seeds and things like that. Poppy seeds, the seed that grows the poppy plant that they get the opium out of the poppy plant. Mm-hmm. And I was standing outside one of the stalls of the bazaar and behind this old beat-up car, and I heard a shot fired, and I heard the round hit the car that was behind me. So I kind of had my guard up after that, trying to employ all the tactics and techniques that I learned through my previous missions and my training as a FAST team member and a Detroit Police SWAT team member. And so right about that time, the insurgents did a call to arms over their loudspeaker system thing they had around there. And today's your day to die. We must rid the infidels out of the land. We must kill them. You know, you must rise up. We must drive them out. And then the incoming fire drastically increased. We heard the Australians really getting into it with them. We had the Marine Air Wing providing close air support to us. Basically, those are gunships that can suppress the insurgents or enemy if they're trying to maneuver in on us or they spot them, you know, being aggressive. So we really heard them get into it with them.
I mean, what you're basically hearing gunfire is what you're saying, right?
Yeah. Yes, a lot of it.
Yeah. And just to back up again, Joe, forgive me, just to make sure our audience is following along with us. Can you take me back to what you heard on the speaker and what that means? Where's that coming from?
That's coming from like one of the leaders of the insurgents to kind of rally them. It's kind of their rallying cry that, you know, we must rid the infidels being us. We must kill them. We must drive them out. Trying to get them motivated to, I guess you would say, push a harder attack against us.
All of a sudden, you're hearing this on the speaker. The instructions are coming through the speaker. They're rallying.
Yes.
You know, basically like, go get them.
Yes.
Okay. And so you're hearing this rallying cry.
Yes.
Right? And then you're hearing the it's getting more intense.
Correct.
And where are you? What are you doing at this point?
Continuing the search. And at this point, we began the process of kind of documenting everything we found, evidential items, and we can't take all the things with us, so we usually will just take representative samples of things, take photographs, and then we'll destroy the stuff and the evidence in place. And we were in the process of doing that.
And this is, I mean, you're saying it so calmly, Joe, but this is, you know, this is the moment. You guys are working fast and trying to get out of there. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is a matter of minutes or?
Time on the ground, probably a couple hours. We're just about wrapping up, so we call for our helicopters to come pick us up. So they're en route to come pick us up, and then we start moving to our positions where we're staged to pick us up at.
And how many of you are there together?
We had four helicopters that day. And each helicopter probably had around 15 people or so on the helicopters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you're waiting.
And we're trying to move to our position to be picked up. Then we get bogged down into the gunfight. So much so that it stalled our progress where we had to wave the helicopters off and tell them we're not ready to be picked up. So we told the helicopters, we can't get there right now. We'll let you know when we get there. So they took off and went a short distance away out of sight and where they were ready to come get us. And then at this point, you know, we're bogged down in the gunfire. We're trying to move from mud hut to building and trying not to get shot to try to move to our positions.
Yeah.
So finally, we get to our positions, get ready, and here comes the helicopters. Three helicopters end up landing. One does not. Sometimes you get what's called a brownout, where the helicopters come in and the rotors kick up a lot of dust and it's hard to see for the pilots.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So three land. So the Afghans, our Afghan partner force, was supposed to get on a Pacific helicopter. That one was the one that did not land. But they end up running to the next nearest helicopter to get on. So they're on the wrong helicopter. We're telling them, you need to get off. And of course, they don't want to move, and I don't blame them, because there's just a hail of gunfire coming down.
Gosh.
So we're standing in an open field here at this point with incoming rounds, and we're just, okay, just screw it. Just go.
Inside Crime is brought to you by DoTerra. The DoTerra drug deactivation pouch provides an easy and effective way to get rid of unused or expired medication. The DoTerra pouch makes addictive drugs like opioids unusable in minutes. Just place the medication in the pouch and mix with water. Be a part of America's solution to reduce drug abuse. Learn more at DoTerraSystem.com. Stay safe, stay ready with DoTerra.
So we're standing in an open field here at this point with incoming rounds, and we're just, okay, just screw it. Just go. I don't want to get shot standing in this open field. So
yeah,
those three helicopters take off. So it's fast team guys and a couple Australian guys left. So we take cover in a ditch. And of course, all the incoming gunfire is focused on us at this point. So our helicopter lands a short time later in an open field, approximately 100 meters away or so. So it lands, and I remember saying to myself, this is going to be a real shitty run, because we have to traverse a wall of gunfire to get to this helicopter. So yeah, we got up and ran, and I remember firing a couple shots on the run towards the direction the insurgents were shooting at us from. And like I said, they had the high ground, and they had a superior position over us.
And it's, I mean, it just sounds like you're open targets right there.
Yes.
But you got to get away, right?
Yes, we got to get in this helicopter. And, you know, not only small arms, it to include belt-fed machine gun fire was coming in on us.
Well, I mean, because what is the other option?
To stay out there, right? Yes.
Yeah. You got to go.
You want to get the hell out of there. So talking to my teammates later, I guess I got to the helicopter about mid-pack, and I paused and continued providing gunfire, while the rest of my team got on or near the helicopter. Once that happened, my team leader, Jared Johnson, tapped me. He said, let's go.
Okay.
I don't remember this. At this point, I guess I turned left to run on the helicopter, and that's when I got struck in the head. We believe it was an armor-piercing round from a belt-fed PKM machine gun. We don't know. We don't have the round. The round hit the right side of my helmet in the temple area, went straight through the helmet, went through my right temple, through the frontal lobe of my brain, and then out my left temple. And at this point, I guess I just fell face down into the ground, and my team knew something was funny about it, because it's not like one of those things you put your hand out to stop your fall. I just fell like a sack of potatoes. And my team leader came over to me. He tried to rouse me. I'm not moving. I'm face down in the ground. And then he rolls me over, and he basically sees the safety ballistic glasses kind of I was wearing were shattered, and he sees the hole in my head. They think I'm dead. They grab me, throw me on the helicopter. Why another?
Because fire, the incoming fire is still happening, right?
Yes.
So and they're then trying to get you. Yeah.
Get me in the helicopter. One of our other teammates starts providing suppressive fire. They throw me on the helicopter thinking I'm dead. We take off. They begin to look at me thinking I'm dead. And my one teammate, Justin Vanderbilt, who also used to be an EMT in his former life, he's like, he's breathing. So he's alive. God. So they get my stuff cut off me. They begin to work on me. They try to get the bleeding stopped in my head. It's like I'm bleeding from both sides, both temples. Mm. And then they go to stick what's called a nasal pharyngeal airway up my nose. It's usually indicated for like facial injuries and stuff to try to get a little better airway. Now, in training, we have to stick these up each other's nose. And it's like a long tube with like a funnel end on the other side, and it goes into your nose and like down your sinus cavity to help you breathe better. And if they're not fun, and we get to use like lidocaine a little bit to kind of deaden it up in training, but they still suck. And when they were sticking it up my nose, I guess I came to. Don't remember this.
God.
I wasn't complaining about my head, even though I had a hole in each side. I just said I had to get it, get it out of my eyes. The bullet didn't hit my eyes, but the pressure of the high-velocity round going through my head ruptured both my eye globes and detached both retinas very, really bad. And I was complaining about my left leg. I said I got to move my leg. And they thought I was shot in the leg, too, with all the incoming fire. But what had happened is I had been shooting quite a bit, and when I got knocked unconscious, I laid on the hot barrel of my rifle, and it burned inside my left knee pretty good. So they're rushing me to the base we were staying at, Terrencout, as quick as they can. They're treating me for shock, talking to me, doing stuff like that. And I guess I was making sense. I knew where I was. I knew who everybody was.
Gosh, it's incredible.
So they got me to the base we were staying at, Terrencout, brought me into the medical facility they had there and did what they could do for me. And then a short time later, they transported me via medical helicopter to Kandahar Airfield, where they had a neurosurgeon and eye surgeon standing by. So they fly me over there with one of my teammates.
And do you remember any of this at all?
No, do not.
No. Okay.
They had me out there at Terrencout. They put me unconscious, but I don't remember landing or anything. So they received me into the medical facility there, and at this point, I'm starting to deteriorate more. I guess I'm being kept alive by some basic life-saving means, and they think they can't save me. They thought at this time they were just going to let me pass peacefully and get what's called an angel flight, which is a plane to fly me back to the States deceased. The neurosurgeon, Rob Rosenbaum, takes a look at me, and he gets some more intel. He sees that I was in really good shape, talks to my teammates, and one of the things that worked in my favor, too, it was Halloween, so it was a slow day for them. So he's like, he has to decide, can this person take and survive what I'm about to do as far as this operation? And he felt strongly that if he got in and stopped the swelling in my head that was going on, that he can reverse what was going on and at least get me back to the States alive. They didn't know how I would be as far as brain-wise or anything like that. So he worked on me for about 4.5 hours and pretty much removed all the frontal cranial bone piece in the front of my head, cleaned up everything. And then the eye surgeon came in, and basically she had to piece my eyes back together with a microscope. And she worked on me roughly 8 hours. Next morning, they get a medical flight to fly me back to the States. We had to stop in Landstuhl, Germany at our medical facility there en route. The pressure in my head was rising, so I stayed there, I think, 3 nights. I was flown back with one of my partners and good friend, Travis Brooks. He was with me.
I mean, you're still in a stage where we don't know what's going to happen with you. I mean,
no,
right?
They didn't know. So during this time, of course, they notified my family, family in the Detroit metro area, my fiance at the time in Virginia, and they had them all staged in Bethesda, Maryland, waiting for me to arrive at Walter Reed National Naval Medical Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. they let my family see me. Of course, I'm a disaster. And my fiance at the time, she was an intensive care nurse. And I guess when she saw me, she put her hand over her mouth and screamed and ran out of the room and passed out. So, I looked in bad shape. They had me in an induced coma for about a week and then brought me out of the coma. And like I said earlier, at this time, they didn't know how I was even going to be.
And all right.
So they brought me out of the induced coma, and that's the first memories I have. Remember my family being there, talking to my family. And I was a little confused at first. They asked me, you know, Joe, where do you live? Oh, I live in Detroit. What do you do? I'm a Detroit police officer. What's your dog's name? Max, which is my very first dog I ever had as a kid. But short time after that, I realized who I was at the time and where I was working and where I was living. So they had me in intensive care there. Started kind of, I would say, my rehab in the hospital.
And what was the prognosis at that point? What had they told you or your family?
They told my family, with my eyesight, probably nothing at all. Now, with my brain, with the injury to your frontal lobe, that's kind of like your decision-making process of your brain. They had told my family, oh, he could never be trusted with a credit card ever again. He could just be at work and take all his clothes off. You know, that infects your impulse control also. So they didn't know exactly how that frontal brain lobe injury was going to affect me.
What happens next?
We started doing basic skills like, Joe, okay, today you're going to put your socks on, your shorts and this and that. And so I started doing stuff like that, just doing basic things, learning to walk around and maneuver, being blind and stuff like that. End up spending 3 months, 2 months there. 2 months in Walter Reed, and they pretty much did everything they could. And at this time, I was wondering, you know, what am I going to do with my life? But there was good support things, and they'd have different veterans come talk to me and different special ops guys. And I just was curious. I wanted to know, you know, how you're used to operating at a real high level. How do you get used to not doing that anymore? And they really help with that. You know, when bad things happen to you, and a lot of bad things are going to happen to you in life, unfortunately, you can make two choices. You can hide in a corner and let life pass you by, or you can get out there and do as much as you can do. And I made a commitment that I'm going to get out there and do as much as I can do. And I tell people, it's not easy. It's hard and difficult, but I made that commitment that I wanted to do as many things blind as when I could see. So I kind of set my attitude to do that. And it led to me being able to do a lot of things now that people never thought I'd be able to do again. So
let's talk about some of those things, Joe.
I actually got back into working out again, and I'm actually competing blind as a national level bodybuilder in a master's class at a very high level and doing very good. And hopefully I will turn pro this year.
It's amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Wow.
I've ran 5K races since being blind. I played golf being blind, which I learned in blind school, and I tease people I probably play better golf blind than what I can see, but you don't have to worry about taking your eye off the ball because you can't see the damn thing.
There you go.
I also hunt and shoot blind with the help of special equipment. Since blind, I've shot 4 deer, and I got 2 alligators in Louisiana last year.
Alligators?
Yes. I don't know if any listeners ever saw Swamp People, or have you seen Swamp People, how they catch these gators?
I have not, but I can only imagine.
With a treble hook with the pieces of chicken or other meat on there, and you catch them, you got to pull them up next to the boat and shoot them. So you talk about some pucker factor, especially when we had the 10-foot gator, the big gator we had on the line. I'm like, Joe, what are you doing out here? I said, this gator jumps up and snaps at you. You can't even see to jump back. But it was fun. You asked me if I'd do it again. Yes, I'd do it again. I got a chance to go skydiving in Northern California, which I did, and that was a blast. an agent that we work with out in Northern California in the Monterey area has a connection out there. So was able to do that, and the sky's the limit. They have blind kayaking and other things, and so I'm still looking to do more stuff.
The sky is the limit for you. It's just amazing to hear, Joe. Can you talk a little bit more about that point where you have that talk with yourself?
It was scary. It's like, man, how are you going to, you know, you get a perception of blind people growing up. It's like, how am I going to do this? You know, if I'm by myself or different things, how am I going to do things? You know, it's a very scary, scary feeling. But the only thing that comforted me, they had other blind people that came and talked to me. And then they have, the psychologist talked to you and different things, and that helped. And, you know, you have blind instructors that talk to you, and they show you how to move around and navigate. And technology is available to help you now as far as with, like, the iPhones and iPads with the voiceover and talking, and there's talking software on the computer. So it makes it a lot easier being blind nowadays with technology, and technology is great.
Well, you sound so positive about it, but I'm sure you had to get to a point where you could, you know, take that all in and move forward, right?
Yes.
There had to be some processing before that happened.
Definitely. I remind myself that somebody always has it worse than you, Joe. It could be worse. And I've never quit anything in my life, and I've never been a quitter, and think that drive has really helped me a lot. You know, there'd be times now where I'd just be sitting at home, and I'll get emotional. I'll just start crying. You know, it's tough. It's still a tough battle every day, but I'll go to bed and wake up in the morning and say, you know, today's a new day. You know, let's see what we can do. You know, there's always tomorrow. So I just try to stay as positive as possible. I tell you what, DEA through this has been very, very supportive, and they've really, really taken care of me and actually still kept me on the job. And there's nothing that my family or me has been wanting for since I've got injured. So I give DEA kudos for that, for sure.
That is incredible. Can you tell us about what you're doing for DEA now and how that has worked into your life? What your routine is now?
Yes, I got transferred back to Detroit, Michigan last March. That's where all my family is, and that helps out being closer to family. I'm what's called the Demand Reduction Coordinator in our Detroit division. Basically, you go out to different groups and community organizations and talk about what dangers with drugs are in their area, and, you know, how DEA is combating it, and different treatment strategies and resources and things that community have to go to try to help out with those programs. DEA is doing this 360 program right now where, you know, we're just not focusing on just arresting our way out of the problem, where we're going and, you know, talking about the rehab piece and successfully doing that and how families can deal with that. So we're focusing on the whole picture, try to beat this opiate problem the best we can, because it's just killing so many people right now. I also go around and I do my motivational speaking through DEA, and about basically I talk about overcoming adversity. And then that leads into talking to other police groups and other community groups also. So it kind of all works together.
It all works together. You're in a really good space, it sounds like.
Going out there and doing what I do now, I get self-satisfaction knowing that I'm helping people. So that makes me feel good. And, you know, I've talked to some of these groups and organizations and things where people really felt crappy about their life, and they had remarks come back and say, you know, listen to your story, Joe. I really didn't have it that bad.
What is your main message to people now when you go out, when you speak, when you talk to them? Because you have such an opportunity and such a unique story.
I really stress the importance of not giving up and not quitting. You know, and I stress that life is not fair a lot of times, and a lot of bad things happen to us, and it's how we deal with that. We can't control what happens at times, but you just have to try to make the best out of the situation you have at the time. And just talk about resilience like that. Never giving up, never quitting. And when I talk to the law enforcement crowd or military crowd, and you know, if you're in a fight for your life, you just can't quit, you can't give up. You gotta keep doing whatever you can. I'm going to survive, I'm gonna make it. Or if you get, you know, critically hurt, that you can't give up, you can't quit. You have to stay in the fight.
There's no question you are a true American hero. But do you think of yourself that way, Joe?
No. I just feel that I'm somebody who did my part. You know, there was a need for it. I thought I could go help and do my part, and that's what I did. And people ask me, if you had to do it all over again, what happened to you? Would you do it again? I always say, in a heartbeat.
Knowing what you know now.
Yes, in a heartbeat. You know, because you tell people, it always can't be somebody else. It always can't be somebody else's son, husband, brother, sister, whatnot. Somebody has to go. For our country to have the freedoms we do, there's a lot of sacrifice.
Well, thank you for your sacrifice, Joe. We can't thank you enough for your sacrifice and your service to our country.
It's my honor and pleasure.
And that's it for this edition of Inside Crime. I encourage you to go to our website to see pictures of Joe in action before and after his injury. Trust me, you'll be even more impressed with his story when you take a look. Our website is insidecrime.com. You can also learn about the DEA Survivors Benefit Fund, a nonprofit organization that helped Joe and his family. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Angeline Hartman. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode of Inside Crime.